I love the fact that John Ossoff, if this is true, I've heard that he writes all his own speeches.
Really?
That is so impressive.
You got to give him credit for also responding to questions where it's no advanced writing at all, but he is very articulate.
Yes.
In dealing with tough questions and turning them to advantage, which is not an easy process. The more I talk about him, the more I like him.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. Thanks so much for joining me today. I am delighted to welcome the New York Times columnist, Thomas Edsel, who writes a very interesting column that's kind of a conversation. I think it's a unique invention on Tom's part. So, Tom, thank you so much for joining me.
Very, very good to be here.
So, the topic that I want to address is one that you had a kind of blistering piece about a week or so ago. And it was called something along the lines of, if Democrats want to win elections, here are the things they need to do. So I guess you must have been responding to the fact that progressive left, the Democratic Socialists of America, are having a bit of a moment. And you have quite different advice. So why don't you tell us your analysis of the situation?
Well, in addition to the Democratic Socialists, the party itself has had basically three major problems connecting to the electorate. And just to preface it, I would say it's a moment where you see Donald Trump having unfavorable ratings, sort of unprecedentedly bad, but the Democratic Party's favorability ratings are slightly worse than the Republican Party's. So something's off in here. And what I would say what's off is that voters feel the Democratic Party has gone over the top on a series, or under the top in another way, on a series of issues. One of the controversial ones that had a key role in 2024 was the transgender question. Could trans women play on women's sports teams? Could they go into women's prisons? And then there's the whole question of transition surgery, all of which are opposed by significant majorities of Americans, including in most cases, Democrats. My proposal was that they should have one party plank in the platform in 2028, explicitly declaring that there are two sexes, that women, trans women, should not play on women's sports teams or enter women's prisons. And transgender surgery has had so much fraught analysis and discussion that for the moment, at least, it should be prohibited for children 18 and under.
Let's probe this a little bit. So when you presented this to several Democrats, what kind of reaction did you get on that issue?
Well, from centrist Democrats, it was pretty positive. And in fact, they had different approaches, but somewhat similar to what I wrote. The Third Way is one of those groups. But when I presented it to a very pro-trans group, they were adamantly opposed, and they wouldn't answer my question, sort of basic question when you're in this debate, are there two sexes or are there more than two sexes? That's a litmus test to get into this debate. If there are more than two sexes, anyway, we're in a different world.
Well, I think if I understood you correctly, you think that if you take the position that there are more than two sexes, you alienate a lot of working class and non-college educated voters who think that you're kind of crazy or out of touch.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. That most people, especially working class people, think there are two sexes and no more. And they think people who talk that way are a little bit off the wall. They're, and more importantly, politically, they're not going to trust someone who believes that there are more than two sexes to govern the country.
Whenever you have political coalitions, you know, you have to worry about how things will be perceived by all members of the coalition. So, you know, if there are significant numbers of progressives who think, well, wait a minute, this position of saying there are only two sexes and no transgender women on sports teams and no transgender women in women's prisons and so forth, they're going to say, well, you are really just embracing the Republican position here. You're throwing trans people under the bus. This is a civil rights issue. And they may feel alienated from any candidate, and they may be less inclined to come out and vote. How do you respond to that?
Well, you can respond to it two ways. One is just plain factually. Virtually all studies and all scientific work says that there are two sexes. And it is beyond debate almost, but not quite. There are some people in science who will argue for more than one, but it is not a, it's just not a credible position in most scientific communities, factually. Politically, it may be that transgender people would feel just sort of dumped on the side of the road. But I'm not sure, one, how many transgender people are committed to these more controversial aspects. Secondly, they are a tiny fraction of the population. So what you lose, what you might lose from transgender support on election day, you theoretically will gain working class voters, or you'll have a shot at gaining working class voters in far larger numbers, the kind of numbers that make it possible to be a majority. So it, I think on both reality and purely as a political strategic choice, the argument is pretty strong in favor of a tough stance on transgender issues.
Let me try this on you. Instead of having a plank in the Democratic platform that says there are two sexes and no more, which will get some people's backs up. I mean, I agree with you. There are two, you know, I happen to think that's factually correct, but maybe you could do something a little, stark. Maybe you could say that the subject of transgender medicine is still developing. There are people who feel that they are born in the wrong body and they deserve complete respect and honor in our society. And it's, you know, when you're an adult, it's up to you how you want to present to the world. And we would not dream of having discrimination against people who are transgender, and they, you know, should not be thrown out of the military, for example, or discriminated against in other ways. But because the science is still quite unsettled, we think that that transgender surgeries, for example, for people under the age of 18 go too far and that we need more time to evaluate the science. What about something like that?
Well, it's possible. I just don't know whether the Democratic Party has dug itself so deeply in a hole that it has to really break with the past. My strategy in proposing these platform changes was to make a clear break with past policies that Democratic candidates and have often adopted, including Kamala Harris, who really went over the top when she ran for president in 2020, and to sort of break that linkage in a pretty, I agree, pretty brutal fashion. But I'm not sure if that's necessary to free the party from the anchor-like effects of the transgender issue, which has pulled it down.
And I guess people who share your view would say, it's true that this is not a big issue for most voters, but it symbolizes something about the Democratic Party, that it is too beholden to special interests, too afraid to just tell the truth about basic things for fear of offending somebody, right?
You took the words out of my mouth. That's right where I was going when you stepped in and
I read your piece. So now that, you know, half our audience is enraged and saying, I'm not watching any more of this, I'm turning it off, let's move on. So the point being that, might as well say this, which maybe I should have said in the introduction, which is, you're very worried about the Democrats being able to defeat the fascist Republicans, right? I mean, that's the point here, is that the Republican Party has become so toxic that it is highly necessary to make sure the Democrats can compete. And at the moment, the Democrats are suffering from a poor opinion by swing voters who are going to be key in 2026, but also in 2028, right?
I should give you all my speaking obligations. No, I agree with that. In order to have a competitive, even Democratic Party, much less a winning, it's a very important, I think, Trump is a truly toxic person. He has done things that are unimaginably bad for the country, bad for the economy, bad for individual people, bad for poor people, bad for Medicaid recipients, Medicare recipients, across the board. And he and the MAGA wing of the Republican Party have to be defeated, and ideally defeated in a way that the Republican Party returns to its roots or goes on another track altogether. And so I think this is very important, both politically and substantively. If the country is going to move ahead and move past Trump, the Democrats are the vehicle to do that at the moment. The Republican Party, in a new world, might take a role in that, but we don't have that right now, given the makeup of the two parties and the absolute loyalty that Trump commands among the leadership in the House, Senate, and across the board.
Yes, and he has transformed the Republican Party so that even once he is off the stage, it is by no means obvious that the Republicans will revert to the pre-Trump era. The people who stand to inherit the party are just as offensive, J.D. Vance being the prime example, just as anti-democratic, just as cruel. And so the Democrats have to look in the mirror and figure out what they need to fix so that they can compete effectively against those people. And so what is your second issue that you think is a weakness? Well, I should say, it's not that just what you think. You're basing this on lots of surveys of voters and swing voters about what things, how they perceive Democrats. One famous survey found that voters think Democrats are weak, woke, and out of touch. So what's your second issue that you think does the most damage and that Democrats need to reform or change?
Well, a larger issue, a larger constituency is immigration and border control. Democratic Party under Biden really endorsed open borders. And again, people don't want a country where there are not boundaries clearly set and that the people who enter the country enter it legally, and the ones who enter it illegally are either stopped at the border or deported. It's not sort of an iffy question. Those are the positions that the majority of Americans stand for. The Democratic Party has unfortunately been associated with this, open borders, with allowing immigrants to come in, illegal immigrants to come in, And this, again, is one where I think a strong declarative, i.e. in a platform, statement of the Democratic Party supports legal immigration and even supports the DACA restoration of a chance to get citizenship for the DACA kids. They're no longer kids. And even for those who have been in the country for a substantial period of time, committed no crimes during that period, paid their taxes, and they've become integral parts of American society and the American economy, they should have a chance to for getting a green card first and then a chance to get citizenship. It's not blanket anti-immigration, but it's basically pro-legal immigration and pro-immigration for those who have really demonstrated a long-term commitment to the country. But I think it's a clear statement that the border will be enforced under a Democratic president and a Democratic administration, and that those crossing it illegally will be sent back without question, is again one of those issues that voters are wary of a party that's unwilling to put limits on things. And limiting and controlling immigration is one of the things voters want done. And they are not prepared just to sort of have a laissez-faire policy on immigration. So that's sort of my position. It is my position.
Do you think that the nature of the immigration enforcement that we have seen in Trump 2.0 changes the calculation at all? I mean, people have seen that when the Republicans, so they saw under Biden that the border wasn't secure. I don't necessarily agree with you that Biden endorsed open borders, but okay. But people had the perception that the border was not secure, and they reacted very negatively to that. And there was, there were a lot of crossings. Okay. But under Trump 2.0, they have seen the other extreme of Republican enforcement that goes far beyond anything that most voters thought they were voting for. These roundups, the killing of American citizens, the sending immigrants who may not have committed any crime. In some instances, we know that they were never convicted of any crime, to foreign gulags and prisons. All of this has also arguably soured voters on the Republicans' approach. Does that change your calculation at all?
Yes. Well, what it does is the Republican excesses, and they have been terrible, have opened the door for the Democratic Party to take a tough stand on immigration, but a moderate one in terms of the Dreamers, in terms of those who've been in this country for a number of years and have been working, and give them a chance. I think that would not have been possible without Trump's excesses and his abuses of immigration enforcement. So I think Trump, in a way, has done Democrats a favor of being able to adopt a position on immigration that is strong on the border, but is not totally preclusive of giving a shot to people who deserve it for various reasons. It has they're still allowed to be a somewhat liberal policy on granting citizenship. And I think Trump is the guy who has allowed this situation. People have really turned against Trump. The polls, it's used to be his strongest issue. I'm not sure, it may still be, but it's not no longer a favorable issue. He's now in the red on the issue. And if anything, it's open the door for Democrats.
Do you think that Democrats can even go a little further? Because the reality is that our birth rate continues to fall, and we definitely need people. And Democrats, you know, you could say Democrats should not be leery of arguing that we need more legal immigrants, that they make a positive contribution. By the way, there's polling from PRRI that shows that people actually do believe that immigrants are a net advantage to our society, that they contribute more than they take, and that we need them. And, you know, wouldn't that be in this environment, wouldn't that be possible? As long as you say you're going to, there won't be chaos at the border, there won't be people just flowing through who have not been vetted, but that we need a more welcoming legal immigration system, which has been broken for a long time and now is badly damaged by the Trump years.
Do you mean raising the limits?
Yeah.
Different categories of legal immigration?
Yes.
I think that that's quite, yes. What can I say? That can be done and that would not be perceived. It would be legal immigration. People are not upset about legal immigration. And I think, as you say, there is pretty widespread knowledge that a lot of the work in this country gets done by immigrants, legal and illegal, and opening the door to having that work continuing to be done, and the benefits that those people provide for the country and for the economy are more than worth it. And you're right that that case could be made for raising significantly the legal immigration limits. Because we are in a losing battle if we're talking about just Native Americans. They're not reproducing. They're getting too old to reproduce even.
The other opportunity, it seems to me, for Democrats is to make the link between, for example, the fact that it is so hard to buy a house for young people now because the prices have gone up so much. Well, part of the reason the prices have gone up, not the whole reason, but a part of it is labor, the price of labor has gone up because of the crackdown on immigrants. So, and immigrants have a huge role in building houses. So that's another thing that they can point out.
You're right. And I, to go back to your other point, I think what Trump has done has been allowed Democrats to make these arguments without sounding like softies on immigration.
Yeah.
They can sound, now they can make that argument and seem reasonable. Whereas before, I think, before the 2024 election, they had trouble making that argument because it sounded like, oh, that's just the libs caving in again. But
yeah.
Now I think it's got a quality of reasonableness to it, at any rate, that they owe to Trump.
Yeah. And the other thing is that Democrats, this is my editorial opinion, but they need to learn a language of speaking about immigration that does a few things. One, make sure that it focuses on what's good for America, not what's good for the immigrant, right? Like, you know, yes, there are poor, desperate people all over the planet who would love to come here and improve their lives. And that's sad that we can't take them all, but we can't. And it doesn't cut you any ice with the average voter to say, these poor people have nowhere else to go, or words to that effect. So that's one thing. Focus on the benefit to Americans. And then also tie it to the price of goods, the price of groceries, the price of, you know, produce, all those things that rely on immigrant labor, housing. But, and finally, tying it to the tradition of America as a nation of immigrants, that we have always been a beacon and that is part of our heritage. And we welcome legal immigrants because they have strengthened our society and made us who we are. And so many of us can trace our ancestry back to immigrants. I was citing in a recent column that one of the right-wing bigots that was featured on Tucker Carlson's program was saying that heritage Americans are basically the only legitimate people. And how would you determine who a heritage American was? And this fellow said, well, people who could trace their ancestry back to the Civil War, people who fought in the Civil War. And, you know, so who would that exclude? Well, would exclude the family of Antonin Scalia, certainly Elon Musk, who is an immigrant himself. It would eliminate the family of Donald Trump. You can go right down the list. Jonas Salk. I mean, you know, it's a very long list of people who can't trace their ancestry back that far. I certainly cannot. But the point being that we do have, you can tap into a sense of national greatness that was help that was powered by creative, hardworking immigrants throughout our history.
I can't disagree with you. You just
okay.
Your point's well taken. And what can I say? You're too smart.
You're a great guest. You can come on anytime. Let's turn now to the topic of crime. Another area where you think Democrats need to shore up their image.
In this case, the problem has really been in the area of electing district attorneys and other law enforcement personnel who are basically very lenient, that they oppose bail. They don't want to prosecute a minor misdemeanors. I think it's not as if the whole party has gone crazy and pro-crime, but that a key part of it, the prosecutorial wing, has, and again, it's not all of them by any means, but San Francisco, Philadelphia, places in Virginia, places all over the country, where the prosecutors themselves have taken positions that basically go too far in the leniency they apply to criminals, but it allows criminals to stay on the street and do further harm. The no bail issue is a big one. The failure to prosecute minor crimes. These kids who take over drug stores or grocery stores, I think it's called wilding. That's not a minor crime in the eyes of someone who was caught in that drugstore and just sort of surrounded by this melee of kids just grabbing everything in sight and then running off. They may be misdemeanors that these kids are doing, but most people do not want to see that behavior go unpunished. It's pretty terrifying to someone who's caught up in it. In this case, the Democratic Party needs to be committed to the prosecution of crimes. If there's any violence, the absolute prosecution to the fullest extent, the longest sentence they can persuade a judge to grant. And also they have to be more reluctant in plea bargaining if they're letting people lower their from a major felony down to a misdemeanor or just a moderate felony. People are wary of a Democratic Party that's not prepared to make firm statements about where the line is drawn, and they see the Democratic Party as being too loose in the way they draw that line. It's not the fault of all Democrats by any means, but it is on the front lines a significant fault and a significant liability. And I think, again, that needs a strong position on the platform that these issues will be prosecuted when warranted to the full extent, and that the no bail stuff that would be abandoned, and along with other policies adopted by some of these prosecutors.
It isn't just white redneck Republicans who feel strongly about the issue of crime. It's Black and Hispanic voters who live in cities. It's, you know, it's the working class. It's people who are, you know, less insulated from violence and disorder than others, than wealthy people. And if the Democrats are perceived as not being protecting their neighborhoods, that doesn't go over well. And so it's something that the Democratic Party has trouble wrapping its arms around. They may think that being tough on crime means you're trying to appeal to, you know, racist white Republicans, but that's really not true.
In fact, your point brings up another major issue, that crime, immigration, and even transgender all fit under kind of a roof that the Democratic Party is too elitist. It's now dominated by college-educated, largely white, very activist Democrats, and that these are a different category, and the party is no longer the party of the working class itself. And by pushing these policies, the party accentuates its eliteness and its lack of working class representation in its thinking. I think elitism is sort of the larger encompassing problem Democrats face. And then when they adopt policies that are only held by elites, they sink their own ship. They just accentuate their own liability in a very self-damaging way.
One Democratic candidate was able to deal with this perceived weakness of his party very well, and that was Bill Clinton, who ran on a platform of hiring, 100,000 cops around the country. I think that is a real opportunity for the Democratic Party this year. They should be saying all that money that the Trump and Republicans spent on ICE, all of it should just be repealed and spent on hiring cops. That's a much better use of law enforcement. What do you think? How do you like my platform, Plank?
So far, your platform's doing pretty good. The problem is, when Bill Clinton did that in 1991 and 92, in a very conscious way, he had a very fully thought out agenda that was probably the most purposeful agenda of any presidential candidate I have ever seen. And I've been around for a while. But he had a big advantage that is no longer there. More than half of his voters in the Democratic Party were working class. So he could run and win in primaries. They were receptive to his message. Yeah. Now the party, over the past, whatever that is, almost 30 years, 28 years, the party has changed substantially demographically, and it's a tougher sell now for a candidate to run as you describe. And as good as it would be, and as good as the arguments would be, the guy or woman has to win the nomination before they can be in the general election. And the nomination now has processed with Democratic primary voters, has become something of an obstacle.
Yes, the primary process is a huge problem, and not just at the presidential level, but at every level of our system, arguably. I'm a big fan of Unite America's work. Nick Troiano was on my podcast talking about reforming how we do primaries, but that's a subject for another day. So let me have you respond, if you would, to something that you hear from people on the left. They say all of this advice about how Democrats need to moderate, that's not true. Look at what happened in the Republican Party. They were urged by their autopsy in 2013 to moderate on immigration and do various other things. And they didn't. They did the opposite. Trump came along and he became, you know, the avatar, and he won. So if they can you know, embrace their id, why can't we?
Depends on the id. The Democratic Party id has evolved, and it may be that the Democratic Party, whatever you want to call it, its subconscious, its inner being, is now farther out in left field than the public is. The MAGA movement that Trump started was primarily driven by anger at the establishment. He really ran against the Republican Party, against Bush from Florida, Jeb Bush, against all these 16 other candidates or whatever it was that he had against him back in 2016. He was the guy who opposed them, and then he was the guy who opposed the Democratic establishment. He captured that anger. It's a different id in that sense. His id was sellable. The Democratic id may not be sellable. In fact, I would argue it is not sellable. But the fact that it is the Democratic id is a big hurdle for the Democrats. How do you get rid of your subconscious? Can Freud help out in this process? That's a tough one.
Well, so let me just speak from the point of view of someone who moved out of the Republican Party. And I'm not a member of the Democratic Party. I'm not a Democrat per se, but I do want Democrats to win now, and I want to help them win. And that wasn't easy for me. There are a lot of things about the Democratic Party that I am not crazy about, but I do this because I'm thinking about the larger stakes here. And I regard the MAGA movement as an existential threat. And so I would urge Democrats to think in the same terms. Like there are things they may have to embrace that they are not crazy about, but that to do it in the name of winning, the stakes here are very high. And therefore, even though it's not fun to say, you know, maybe to downplay the trans issue or to, you know, whatever, change your views on crime and punishment, or change your policies anyway, that is worth it for the greater good. And you have to keep your eye on the prize.
You're absolutely right. But I don't mean to keep raising problems with it, but for a candidate looking at the primary, trying to win a nomination, has to calculate, how do I piece together what might be painful policies with beneficial policies, and how do I sell them? That Clinton did a whole series of lectures at Georgetown University in which he outlined the logic and rationale. He had it all thought through. It was a major league intellectual achievement for a politician, especially. I don't see any Democratic candidate going through that kind of process at this stage. There's some interesting people out there. I think Josh Shapiro is interesting. I think John Ossoff is interesting. There is a real potential with some of the candidates to do, I think, what you're talking about. And it looks like both Shapiro and Ossoff are tough enough to stand up on that front in a way that is not fully recognized at this point. I really take back what I said when there's no candidate doing it. The more I think about it, there really are. But they have a ways to go to move up in terms of the polling and acceptability. And if the Democrats, in my opinion, if they go back to Kamala Harris, it would be a self-destructive act.
Right. By the way, one of the things that I just would like to say, as somebody who did spend some of my career as a speechwriter, I love the fact that John Ossoff, if this is true, I've heard that he writes all his own speeches.
Really?
And that is so impressive and takes us back to sort of a 19th century model of what it means to be a politician. Actually, we've had speechwriters from the very beginning of our republic. Washington had speeches written for him by Hamilton and Madison and others. But still, it is, I think it speaks well of him. I think that's one of the reasons that his speeches are delivered with so much sincerity. He actually wrote them. I like that for what it's worth.
You got to give him credit for also responding to questions where it's no advanced writing at all, but he is very articulate.
Yes.
In dealing with tough questions and turning them to advantage, which is not an easy process. But he seems to have mastered that. The more I talk about him, the more I like him.
Yeah, same here. So let's keep an eye on that. And everyone should keep an eye on your column, which is available in the New York Times. I'll just say a word about that. What you do is you present a thesis and then you bounce it off people, many academics or political operatives or doctors or whoever is relevant, and you provide their responses. And it's as I said earlier, it's like a conversation. It's very, very good, very informative.
Thank you very much.
Highly recommend it. Thanks so much for joining me today, Tom Edsel.
My pleasure. It's good to see you.
Likewise. Okay, yeah. Take care.